Hello, this is Rachel from Scavenger's Hoard. I'm recording this on 11th of April, 2023. And this is basically an introduction to what's a very special episode of this podcast feed. I was very lucky to get the opportunity to record a live podcast at Star Wars Celebration London on the Saturday in 2023. Our chosen subject was the mythology of the sequel trilogy. I did the panel with Marie Claire from What the Force and our friend Laurie. This recording is essentially the whole panel live. So you'll notice a different type of sound to the recording from usual. Probably clearer, to be honest, because Marie Claire has better kit than me. I'm really excited to share this panel with you. I won't keep on waffling because I think the panel speaks for itself. It's a lot of the sorts of topics and themes Kirsty and I have discussed on the podcast. Obviously different voices and different perspectives. Also trying to be super concise because we had to talk about all three films in an hour. So yeah, not an enviable task, but I feel like we did pretty okay. I'm pleased with how it went. Just a huge thank you to my co-panelists and also everyone who attended in person. Honestly, it was so emotional just to be there and just to appreciate how much enthusiasm there was for the material and how much interest people had in it. So yeah, thank you to everyone who showed up, and to those of you who weren't able to be there, I hope you enjoy this recording. Towards the end, we talked very briefly about our feelings about the news of Rey's return. We were running out of time at that point, so my response was literally one word. So I will actually tag on a little bit extra to expand my feelings on that reveal at the end of the recording. Obviously Kirsty, unfortunately, was not able to be at Celebration, so is not present in this recording. But rest assured that Kirsty and I will be doing a proper debrief of all the big announcements and reveals at Celebration in our next podcast, which we should be recording this coming weekend. So yeah, look out for that. Thank you, and I hope you enjoy the panel.
All right. I think we can probably get started.
Okay. Wow. Thank you so much for coming, everyone. This is amazing. Like, honestly, just seeing all the people who've turned up, this is incredible. This is Powerful Light, Powerful Darkness, how the sequels expand the mythology of Star Wars. Start with a few introductions. I'm Rachel. I'm one half of the Scavenger's Hoard podcast. We've been going... Thank you. That's so nice. Unfortunately, my fellow co-host Kirsty couldn't be here. I am here. I'm very excited about the presentation we have for you today. We've been going since 2016, and we're heavily sequel trilogy centric. I'll pass over to my co-panelists.
Yeah, I'm Marie-Claire Gould, and I'm the host of What the Force. And I cover Star Wars from a mythological perspective. I'm fascinated by why stories work for me. And I have been obsessed with how we dream forward myths to today. On to you.
Hi, I'm Laurie Cohen-Ashman. I'm a screenwriter and a director. I approach storytelling from a sort of femme gaze, queer, hope punk ideology that is very much informed by mythology. And yeah, I got into all that via Star Wars and via What the Force podcast. So.
Oops.
It's a nice full circle moment that we're having.
So we just quickly want to run through what we're going to cover today. So we're basically going to look at the mythological underpinnings of Star Wars under George Lucas. Then we're going to look at each of the sequel trilogy films and explore how that has its own mythology in a way. Just look at how it has its distinct take on the mythology of Star Wars specifically. And then finally, we're going to ask, how do the sequels bring Star Wars full circle? So we're not letting you know how just yet, but that's what we're going to work towards. I hope everyone's very excited. So I'll pass over to Laurie.
Yeah, so it's your boy. So when we talk about Star Wars as mythology, what exactly do we mean by that? So myths are a form of storytelling, and storytelling is this very fundamental aspect of being human, and myths and fairy tales are the foundation of all storytelling. And when you start to study mythology, You begin to see that no matter the country, the language, the culture, the same kind of types of characters and journeys and themes crop up time and time again. And these storytelling aspects work on this kind of deeply subconscious, psychological level to help us sort of understand ourselves, understand the world that we live in, and these issues that face humanity. So you have themes of like family, love, war, good, evil, redemption, these really fundamental things. So when we talk about Star Wars being a myth, we're basically acknowledging that when George Lucas was conceiving of all of this, he was intentionally using these tropes and character archetypes that are found in myths and fairy tales, you know, the hero, the mentor, the rogue, a princess that needs saving. He's using all that to create a new mythology in response to the time that he was living in and the questions and issues that were sort of facing people, and especially young people and children, that they would need help, like kind of understanding. And the single biggest influence on Lucas in terms of mythology and what he was drawing on was Joseph Campbell.
Yeah, that's a beautiful segue over to Mary Beth.
Yeah, so George actually started to read all about myths and be into it at USC when he was at school at university. He started to be interested in all of this, but it wasn't until he actually had written his second draft of Star Wars that somebody had handed him a copy of Hero with a Thousand Faces, which was written by the very famous comparative mythologist Joseph Campbell in 1949. So just picture that's where we're using this stuff from. And it completely changed George's worldview. He looked at his script and saw that he had been writing the motifs of myth, not just the influences of his childhood, like Flash Gordon and other cinema that he had been influenced by, but also these archetypes and also the journey from a descriptive perspective. And so he adjusted the script of Star Wars to align to what Joseph Campbell had been talking about. Joseph Campbell really wrote the hero's journey as a descriptive story or talking about it because he wanted to point out where the common monomyth came from, so that it is something that is common across all cultures, and it has been very useful for storytellers, but also for people who are in therapy to look back on their own stories and kind of give it a structure and meaning to what they're talking about from their own experiences. George continued on and eventually became friends with Joseph Campbell and actually consulted on Campbell with regards to Willow, the original movie, and what eventually became the prequels before Joseph Campbell's death. And you can still see the hero's journey influencing Star Wars today in The Mandalorian, as well as it was mentioned on the stage yesterday.
Yep.
Exactly. With regards to Rey.
Exactly. The story continues.
The story continues.
Yeah. No, so obviously the story of Luke Skywalker is one of the most famous examples of the hero's journey in pop culture, essentially, and the mapping is pretty obvious. I'm not going to go through it step by step because I thought most of you will be familiar with this, but call to adventure is obviously Luke discovering the hologram of Leia in R2, refusal of the call. Luke obviously initially refuses to leave to Tatooine until he realizes his aunt and uncle are dead, and then he goes. Meeting with the goddess, that's Luke's encounter with Leia. Death the Mentor, Obi-Wan's death. So again, you're seeing how on the nose this is, right? And Master of Two Worlds, that's right at the end of the first movie where, yeah, Luke is communing with the Force and obviously gets that direct hit on the Death Star. And then that's obviously the hero's journey in the first Star Wars. But then there's a bigger arc for Luke across the whole original trilogy where essentially you have to remap the stages according to each of those movies. Again, this isn't focused on the original trilogy, so I won't go into that in depth, but as you can see, the call to adventure remains the same. It's Luke hearing that initial call to adventure on Tatooine. But then the end of that story, when you're looking at the original trilogy as a whole, is Luke obviously now a Jedi, having like reconciled with his father and redeemed his father. And he's now this Jedi with like full mastery and control over the Force. So yeah, the quintessential hero's journey essentially is what you get with Luke Skywalker.
Yeah.
And yeah, I'm going to leave it to Marie Claire to talk about the prequel. To talk about the prequels.
Yeah, and so why are the prequels necessary? Well, George actually talked about it before he released the films, and he said, it's not apparent from the first three movies, but when you see the movies I haven't made yet, that the issue is how we get Darth Vader back to the, is the real central issue. How do we get him back to the little boy that was in that first movie, the good person that loved and was generous and kind? And so when you take the first six episodes, you actually see that Anakin himself goes through a massive hero's journey. He is called to adventure by Qui-Gon and Padme, calming to his planet. He is influenced by the Jedi, influencing his fate and taking him away from the planet. He enters the belly of the whale and into the unknown and into the darkness through the influence of Palpatine, influencing over his life. He meets with the goddess, of course. This is the courtship of Padme. She is his goddess in his life. And he goes on a road of trials, which is the Clone Wars, the entire animated series. And then eventually is stuck in a spiritually dead phase in a little literal walking coffin. He is dead as Vader. That's really, really important. And it's not until he sees Luke suffering that he understands the suffering that he has been going through and experiences an apotheosis and gets energy to fight back against Palpatine, saving his son's life, and then eventually refusing to return with him to the rebels. And becoming one with the Force, and thus the master of two worlds. It's really, really fascinating because Lucas really wanted to show us that return and redemption is the hero's journey.
And what is apotheosis?
Apotheosis.
And I was.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So apotheosis is the realization that we are not separate in the Force. We are one together. We are the rock, the tree. You and I are not separate. It is the key to understanding Star Wars.
And it's part of this like life-death cycle that we see again and again.
When you are reborn, you realize you're part of a bigger thing.
Exactly. Yeah. And the reason we've gone through the original and prequel trilogies before we move on to what's on all the posters about this being about the sequels is to essentially establish background so then we can consider how the sequels are different. So, yeah, I will pass over to Laurie to, yeah, give some context.
So getting into the sequels, I'm going to sort of talk, I guess, kind of creative industry perspective for a little bit. So basically with the Disney takeover, you obviously no longer have George Lucas in the driver's wheel, which you had for the previous six films. But you're obviously still operating within the world and the mythology that he created. So with the decision to create a new sequel trilogy, you kind of face three main issues. Firstly, you're trying to finish the Skywalker saga and create three films that are the final act to an existing two-act, six-film story, which obviously has this very established, very passionate, opinionated fandom spanning almost 40 years, which means you have these existing characters who are legendary and beloved and whose journeys you're trying to give a satisfying end to. Secondly, you are trying to relaunch Star Wars for a new generation and inject new life into a film franchise that has been dormant for 10 years. Via setting up new characters and new journeys, which also intertwine with the old ones. And thirdly, you're faced with the question of how to update the mythological underpinnings that George was using to reflect a world that is now very different from the world that he created Star Wars in. So you're trying to do all of this without that one person in the driver's wheel, which you had with George, which on the one hand is this really exciting opportunity to have like new voices and creators have their take on Star Wars, but it's also a risk and a challenge to like then create a cohesive ending to what so far has been a pretty cohesive two-act story. So yeah, it's a lot, and I don't, as a writer and director myself, I do not envy Ubi's film and the directors
embarking on that.
There's a lot. So much to manage.
Yeah. No.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's get into the sequels proper then. Obviously Force Awakens, directed by J.J. Abrams. And essentially when J.J. was talking in press about this movie, he was saying specifically that he wanted a heroine for this movie. That was like one of the key reasons he wanted to make The Force Awakens, essentially, to tell a female-led story in the Star Wars universe. Essentially what you find in The Force Awakens is, while there are obvious similarities between this film and the original Star Wars, I personally feel it is doing something quite distinct, and I feel like part of that is coming from it using different influences. So I think it really relies a lot on fairy tale influences, for example. And I don't know if any of the... Well, we're all nerds for the Star Wars convention. But yeah, I don't know if any of us have listened to the commentary track for The Force Awakens. But on that track, JJ talks explicitly about fairy tale influences. He references Cinderella and Sleeping Beauty in relation to Rey. And he talks about having a castle and a prince and a princess and all these elements, essentially, in that movie. Is part of wanting to make it this science fiction fairy tale, essentially. And I think one of the things I love most about Force Awakens is the way that it has Rey and it has her going on like a heroic journey, but it's a different kind of journey from the one that Luke goes on. And that's what we're going to get into in a bit more detail. But I think of like a simple way of explaining that is Luke's journey is quite external. It's about accomplishments, it's about mastering the Force. And ultimately, it's a story about him developing personal morality and discernment. But Rey's journey, I find that, and I think all of us find it, to be honest, it's more internal, and it's about like her development of self-knowledge and self-acceptance. With that said, I'm going to pass it over to Mary Claire to introduce a new framework called The Heroine's Journey.
Yeah. So this is Maureen Murdoch's seminal work. She was a Jungian psychologist and psychotherapist who, over the course of her life, and she's still alive, but over the course of her counseling work, found that when she used the hero's journey to help her patients, it lacked something. Primary women were her patients, and it lacked something. It didn't describe everything that they experienced, and they tended to think about things from a very internal transformation perspective, or using symbolism that relied on internal transformation. And I have this quote: "The feminine journey is going deep down into the soul, healing and reclaiming, while the masculine journey is going up and out to the spirit." And this is like key to understanding the differences between what Joseph Campbell was trying to say and what eventually has become sort of the industry standard for telling feminine stories in Hollywood. So even now, stories from Disney across the board use the heroine's journey. It's given out to their executives. It's also taught at like the Disney Family Museum to little kids as a way to talk about journeys from a feminine perspective. It's really important, though, to note that the missing feminine is in reference to feminine characteristics from a culture perspective, masculine characteristics from a culture perspective, and not necessarily gendered. So men can go on a heroine's journey if they're going on a more internalized journey about transformation. And the key to this all is about... Joseph Campbell would talk about men would go on this journey to find the goddess. That is their goal. So you think about Leia at the end of A New Hope. There she is standing there and she gives out the medals. She's the prize, right? But women, according to Campbell, they just need to be there. What does that mean? What does that even mean?
Like, figure it out yourself inside. Just like go inside and like it's just all there.
You're just there. And it was because he was pulling from myths that focused on heroines, and to him, they just sort of needed to
realize that they were the goddess this whole time? He didn't have the symbolic language to talk about what it was like to go on an internalized journey. That's where his gaps are, right? In the end, Murdoch doesn't contradict Campbell. She expands on Campbell. She takes him into a new realm, into this very cognitive, internalized feeling realm, and uses the symbolic language to get us there.
Sorry, I'm a little bit slow. Ray's journey. And The Force Awakens, which is also with Mary Claire.
So just as an intro to The Force Awakens from a symbolic perspective, The Force Awakens. So there's this concept of needing to awaken. We talked about how Campbell referred to all women as goddesses just a moment ago. And yeah, that's the idea, is that internally, all feminine aspects of ourselves is this entire power within us that needs to be awoken. We need to find it deep down inside of us and awaken. And this is exactly what's happening with Rey. She is like waiting for something. She's waiting for somebody to save her, to come home to Jakku and save her. She's like, I know a lot about waiting to BB-8. Well, Murdoch says, women are waiters. Daddy's little girl waits, peering into the darkness of the headlights. In adolescence, she waits by the phone to anticipate the time that he will call. She waits for her first kiss, her first date, her first... It's waiting for others. Stay put, stay good, be a good girl, right? Instead of figuring out where that power deep inside of you is. It's an internal transformation. It's about understanding your own power, your own life, your own sexuality. It's about that this will happen to you too. So The Force Awakens is about inevitability. Rey starts inside of a fallen giant. That's where we come across her. She is in Jakku, in the middle of the heart of darkness, in a sense, waiting to be reborn, almost like a seed. We start on her journey, and she's separated from the feminine because she's been waiting for her family, and she's taken away from the planet and joins the boys' club instantly with BB-8 and Finn, and moves on to identify with that masculine. Han Solo shows up and he's like, hey, all of these things are true. And she's like, this is the Falcon.
What is that though?
What is it though? You know, and she idolizes Han Solo's stories. She idolizes what Chewie's trying to say to her. All the myths are true. They initiate the road of trials. She starts to prove herself. Han is standing in her way a little bit as a threshold guardian, but eventually learns her trust. And they face monsters like the Death Gang, the Kanja Club, and the Rathtars. And Rey overcomes them, but never takes credit for it like maybe a man would have.
That was lucky.
That was lucky? Yeah. She starts to become more confident in her power, but is starting to question whether that's really something she wants. She's been playing in this man's world, and then again, this ties back to something in the heroine's journey, where the first part of it is very much like the hero's journey. There isn't a lot of differences in it, but there's an allusion to this success that she has given up maybe her wanting to belong, her wanting to nurture, the cares that she has wanted along the way to have this power that she has found within the masculine. She's given Han's gun, which is this boon of success. And when she reaches Maz Kanata's castle, there's an awakening that happens. There's a call in the Force that there's something else that's still there for her. She's tempted down into the basement by this whispering, and she touches Luke's lightsaber, and it's given her a vision of sort of how much bigger the universe is and how much more there is to maybe potentially find, or that she can't avoid these things. It is a crisis. She is in crisis. And immediately she faces a goddess-like figure, Maz, who knows the ways of the Force, can guide her, can tell her, hey, this is all right. This is our initiation and descent into the goddess. She has an urgent yearning to reconnect with the feminine because she hasn't maybe fully accepted all of these aspects, and starts the transformation by running into the forest. The forest symbolically represents a cocoon to be reborn. And in her vision, she saw Kylo, which shows to her her fate. She's going to see him again, and she immediately sees him in the forest after. She is taken away like Hades and Persephone from the planet. This ties back to Greek myth and shows that there's a union of opposites needed to complete her journey, and is engaged with her own power when pushed against by Kylo trying to take the information from her brain. It sort of heals her, and she becomes confident in her power and fights him in the forest, taking back the lightsaber, the wounded masculine healed because she accepts the masculine within her. She's able to go beyond duality and accept there's both feminine and masculine aspects of herself in fighting back with him. So this is how she has found her own power, both the masculine and the feminine, and she is more powerful for it.
Oh, lovely. So yeah, it won't surprise you to find out that we actually fought a bit over who would get to talk about The Last Jedi. Big fans of this movie. But yeah, in the end, Laurie won. So yeah, Laurie's job is to talk us through The Last Jedi.
Yeah, so just as a sort of introduction to Rian Johnson as a filmmaker, he's one of my favorite filmmakers. And if you look at his filmography, his approach to storytelling is basically to kind of take these really high concept genres like sci-fi or film noir or whodunits, and then root them in these really character-driven, emotional, empathetic stories about things that make them feel grounded and universally relatable. So his approach to The Last Jedi was basically to take this highfalutin sci-fi fantasy story in space and its mythological underpinnings and really root it in this like coming of age story, basically. And the quote up there is basically him talking about how the hero's journey, his interpretation is that it's actually about the journey from adolescence into adulthood. And I think you can really see that with what he does with the characters. So within the context of this high concept playground, what he's really concerned with is this struggle of growing up and finding your identity that Rey and Kylo are jointly experiencing at the forefront, both of them trying to figure out who am I and what do I want, what do I believe, what is the truth of my world and my story. Outside of their previously held beliefs about their families and where they belong and what their futures hold. But also Finn and Poe are equally grappling with those things. Like when we talk about coming of age, most people think teens, but it's not necessarily, it's about the journey. And you can go through that at any stage because, like, you know, even arguably Luke goes through a sort of middle-aged refresher course of that journey in this film as well, right? So yeah, so that's, I think that's kind of sums up the approach that Ryan was kind of taking yep. with this film. So yeah, let's get into the heroine's journey. So before I kind of dive into this breakdown, I think it's really important to note that whilst this is obviously focusing on Rey's journey, it's kind of impossible to talk about Rey without talking about Kylo. And TLJ, I think, is the film that really clearly sets them up as dual protagonists, mm-hmm. Whose journeys and destinies are intertwined, and it strongly establishes Rey and Kylo as this symbolic pairing, which is later named as a dyad in Tross. So they represent this kind of deeply mythological and very Star Wars duality, right? It's light and dark, masculine and feminine, passion and compassion. And they're constantly positioned in this film as equals and as this kind of yin-yang type symbol of balance and unity. And they act as mirrors to one another in this very kind of like deeply psychological way. They question and challenge each other. They tell each other uncomfortable truths. They're there for each other when no one else is. They're both very lonely. And from a psychological point of view, they represent this Jungian concept of animus and anima, which is one's inner masculine and feminine. So Rey represents Kylo's inner feminine that he needs to stop suppressing and embrace. And Kylo represents Rey's inner masculine that she needs to heal and reform a healthier relationship with. So all of that kind of feeds into Rey's heroine's journey. So let's get into it. So separation from the feminine. So it's pretty simple. Rey has been sent away from the resistance by Leia, this new kind of big female mother figure in her life. Identification with the masculine and gathering of allies. So like she did with Han, Rey is looking at to Luke as this kind of new father figure and a savior. He's going to save the resistance. He's going to teach her all about being a Jedi. She's still looking to these external masculine sources to show her her place in all this, right? Initiation and crossing the first threshold. So this is the first force bond with Kylo. So while she's kind of being rejected by one masculine figure, because Luke is just not interested in anything she has to say, the force kind of intervenes, is like, let's go over here for a hot minute. Let's talk to Kylo. So the force is once again, as it did in TFA, is like intervening and showing her her fate, which she once again rejects at first. She doesn't want anything to do with him. He's a monster. She hates his ass. We get into tests and trials. Luke keeps rejecting her, but Rey's also finding her place, finding herself on this island of Akto, right? And she's surrounded by all of this like really aggressively feminine symbolism.
Lots of caves.
Lots of eggs. Lots of baby porgs and mother sea cows and all this kind of stuff.
Milking.
And yeah, and she and she's but she's like very uncomfortable and she's rejecting it all. So she's like pissing off the fish nuns. She tries to train herself with a lightsaber, but she ends up like physically damaging this very natural island. She's surrounded by these like egg-shaped huts, which she blows a hole in. We have the milking scene, which is like lols, but also is
important.
Symbolically important because it's this very feminine imagery, and she's so uncomfortable she can't even look at it. She looks away, and that is telling us that she is not ready to embrace her feminine power just yet. We get to the illusion of success, which is Luke finally agrees to train her. But it almost instantly goes wrong when he freaks out about her raw power and her being drawn to the dark side, which is basically just kind of code for female intuition and curiosity. He's like, you went straight there, because he's so, you know, paranoid about this because of what happened with Kylo. And this also kind of invokes her growing bond with Kylo that Luke is unaware of. We're getting to awakening
to feelings of spiritual aridity and death, which is basically just a very fancy way of saying depression.
Sadness. Vader in a coffin.
Vader in a coffin. It's like emo vibes. So rejected once again by Luke and confused by this weird relationship with Kylo that's happening. Rey's basically just feeling very lost and confused and doesn't know what to do. Which leads into kind of the most, I think, important sequence in this film in terms of Rey's Heron's journey, which is the initiation and descent to the goddess, which is the Mirror Cave. So this kind of depression and funk that she's in, it leads her to go to the place on the island that has been calling to her, a place that is associated with the dark side, which leads her to the Mirror Cave. So caves are very symbolic of wombs and vaginas. So when Rey falls through it and emerges from the water, she's being symbolically reborn via her own subconscious. In the cave, she's faced with these endless reflections of herself and this mirror, which she asks to show her her family. This is the one thing that she's pinned her entire identity and life around is my family, they're going to come back for me, my family, they're my future, that's what I'm waiting for. That's the belonging that she seeks, but what happens is we have these two shadowy figures, they converge into one figure that then turns into Rey's own reflection. So there's also the widely held theory that just before it becomes Rey's reflection, that is actually Kylo. And so this kind of points to the fact that Kylo is like her shadow self, and she's going to have to accept him, the dark and masculine sides of her psyche, and reclaim them in order to become her sort of true whole self. So the cave is basically telling Rey that she is the only person who can show her her place in all this. She needs to stop waiting for all these external things to tell her what to do. And she needs to embrace her own inner goddess. Everything that she needs is already inside of her. So then we kind of go into urgent yearning to reconnect with the feminine. So whilst this message that Rey receives from the cave is ultimately healing and empowering, you also have to understand emotionally where Rey is. You know, she's set out to find Luke and bring him back to the Resistance, but instead she's confronted by these like very harsh truths about her family and her identity. And to her surprise, she's found that the only person who understands and connects with her and comforts her is Kylo Ren, who is her sworn enemy. So she feels like she's completely failed in her Luke mission. She's now been hit by all these truth bombs, and it's basically emotionally breaks her and reinforces her own loneliness. She's not in a great place, her little baby. And so she speaks once more to Kylo in the hand touch theme. And Kylo is someone who is just as lonely as she is, and she reaches out to him with compassion and empathy, not just for him, but for herself. She's reaching for the feminine. So the hand touch is not just this like beautiful moving moment of connection. It symbolizes Rey beginning to embrace her feminine power and also recognize her wounded masculine that needs healing, which is represented by Kylo. She's saying, I see you and I see that you're like me because I'm learning to see myself more clearly. So then we get into healing the mother-daughter split. This is basically Rey kind of decides to act on this newfound connection with her femininity by going to Kylo, another sort of trip into the symbolic underworld, which is the Dreadnought. She like literally like ships herself to
in
Kylo.
In a coffin-shaped
pod. Yeah. It's very on the nose. But she's taking action. She's deciding that he is her future and taking control of her destiny rather than relying on others for the first time. She's also arguably doing for Kylo what she longed for her own mother to do for
be
her,
there.
Which is to be there and fight for her and come back for her. So healing the wounded masculine. This is where we get into the whole throne room sequence, one of my best sequences in cinematic history. Rey is this catalyst, right, that prompts Kylo to free himself from this toxic relationship he's in with Snoke, because she's like the first person to truly show him, like, with words and with actions, that she believes he can come back to the light. And also just that he's, like, worthy of being listened to and understood and not just treated like crap the whole time. And so through their force bond conversations, she starts sort of challenging him to question his own identity and beliefs. So when he chooses Rey over Snoke in that moment, that's a huge first step for Kylo on this new path for him. So integration of masculine and feminine, this is a throne room fight. So all through the kind of choreography of this fight and the way that it's shot, Rey and Kylo are being depicted as these complete equals who are like super in sync with each other. They're constantly aware of where the other one is. They're passing weapons. They're like helping each other out. In the iconic move where Rey leans on Kylo's back and holds onto his thigh, they're literally being depicted as this like yin-yang symbol of balance. There's also a lot of sexual subtext and symbolism in the scene, if you look for it. There's like a lot of lightsaber innuendos. I'm also like low-key convinced that Rian Johnson has a leather glove kink. I'm just saying. Which, so all of this kind of like marks them as this symbolic coupling that's going on. And yeah, as Rian Johnson said,
it is Snoke's boudoir.
It is Snoke's boudoir. And they burnt it down with passion. So yeah, Rian Johnson has literally said that like the throne room scene is the closest you're going to get to a sex scene in Star Wars. So,
that's true.
Thank you for that. So then our last point is beyond duality. So this kind of integration allows Rey and Kylo to momentarily transcend the duality of masculine and feminine and become this whole being. But then obviously Kylo is still blinded by resentment towards Luke and the Jedi and this sort of dark-sided desire for power and control. And so his next step for him is to make his join me offer to Rey, which I like to think as his version of like Mr. Darcy's botched proposal in Pride and Prejudice. He's like, I'm going to insult the shit out of you and then you're going to love me. And she's like, not so much.
Megan doesn't work.
Yeah. But Rey rejects him and she uses the lie and in order to save resistance because she's much further along her kind of internal journey than he is at that point. And yes, that was a lot.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah, you can have some water now.
Thank you so much.
Take a break. Yeah, so that brings us to The Rise of Skywalker. I'm going to let Mary Claire set me up and then I'm going to go crazy.
Yeah. The key to this story, understanding it mythologically, is the mythology of the dyad. And Chris Terrio was quoted several times actually saying that the concept of the dyad came from Joseph Campbell, and it takes some digging to find it. It's most famously is quoted in Joseph Campbell talking about his own life and his marriage with his wife, and how when you're in a marriage, you sacrifice to the marriage, you end up becoming, there's a two-ness that develops. It's two that are one when you are married, because you have to sort of sacrifice both sides to become this dyad, this dual person. Campbell also later on and in some of his texts actually talks about the dyad being a mythical marriage. A yin-yang is a dyad. He uses different spelling and that's why it's hard to find. But it is the same concept. And essentially it comes to what is this whole point, right? It's the idea that we have to move beyond duality to have balance. Duality is where you end up fighting wars over things, saying light and dark. You instantly create an us versus them opposition. And within ourselves, to fully integrate the missing pieces of ourselves, you have to have both. So it's the idea of both.
Beautiful. Thank you. Yeah, so that brings me to describing Rey's journey in The Rise of Skywalker. So to begin with, right, it's obviously going to be focused on Rey's emotional journey, and I know that can sometimes be a bit hard to track in this film, to put it politely. I'm going to explain my interpretation, essentially, of the starting point for this movie. So, obviously, at the end of The Last Jedi, Rey's story is unresolved at that point, right? So, she's only really just begun her journey in the Force, and, like, pivotally, her relationship with Kylo Ren has no resolution, essentially, because he betrayed her at the end of The Last Jedi by doubling down and proclaiming himself as Supreme Leader. So there's this huge question mark over what's going to happen between them now. So when you get to the beginning of The Rise of Skywalker, the separation of the feminine is essentially Rey distancing herself from Leia, because in between films, Rey's been training with Leia, Leia's been her mentor, and that's essentially been something of a return to the feminine for Rey, because she never had that previously. Leia's this like type of mother figure, like a nurturing figure, and while it's not shown to us, we're to presume that they've had this sort of like maternal nurturing relationship in between films. So yeah, Rey leaving the planet where the Resistance are based is that separation. Identification of the masculine, I'd suggest that that's essentially Rey trying to study the old Jedi ways and studying the Jedi texts, because they obviously establish this like pre-existing framework of what it means to be a Jedi and how to be a Jedi. And at the beginning of the film, Rey's really struggling with that, essentially trying to study them and trying to learn to be a Jedi to the best of her ability. And then initiation, crossing the first threshold, and tests and trials, like these are stages that are also common to the hero's journey. And that's essentially the adventure stuff you get with Rey going off to Pisana, and obviously there's all sorts of like hijinks and adventures and trouble with various people trying to kill them, as happens in Star Wars. I won't go into that in a huge degree of detail. And then you reach the illusion of success. And I rewatched the movie essentially to try and map these points to the film. I don't know what that noise is. So illusion of success. I was rewatching the movie and it kind of struck me for the first time that I think the illusion of success is that on Pisana, when Rey is fighting Kylo Ren, you see her at her most powerful, essentially. You know, she's shooting lightning from her hand, she's able to bring a ship down. You know, she's got this, like, terrifying level of power. But ultimately, that is not really a great thing. You know, that causes her this deep emotional conflict and trauma because she believes she's killed Chewbacca. And she also knows that this extreme power she has is like a symptom, essentially, of some like darkness within her nature. And then over the next few stages, what you have is basically Rey wrestling with that inner darkness. So this spiritual aridity and death, you know, there's so much about Rey just being like incredibly scared. Isolated, yeah. And scared.
Yeah.
And, you know, like actively saying to like Finn, I think, you know, everyone says they know me and no one does, you know, so she clearly feels incredibly alone and she's very upfront about that. And yeah, so I'd say through like pretty much a good hour of the film, maybe, to be honest, from Pisana right up until the fight with Kylo Ren on the Death Star, you know, when they're in the Emperor's throne room and then on top of the Death Star. I feel like that's all this stage, essentially, this depression, as Laurie conveniently termed it. I think it's quite literal in that film, you know, because Rey does seem extremely down, extremely sad, extremely melancholy throughout those stages. And then, obviously, you get the urgent yearning to reconnect with the feminine, and I'd argue that that happens, like, there's a few stages in this movie that happen in a very compressed time frame, and I'd argue that this stage happens when Rey goes to stab Kylo Ren after there's the intervention by Leia, because Rey stabs him, and then in the moment after she stabs him, she recognises that Leia's gone, that Leia's died. And so she's feeling that connection with Leia, and it's this like ultimate yearning that she feels in that moment, in the sense that she really wants to go back to that place that Leia represents, that place of like nurturing and protection. But because she knows that Leia's gone, that's impossible now. And that actually harks back to what Kylo tells her in the throne room, where he's like, you can't go back to her, just like I can. And obviously at that point, Kylo meant, you can't go back to her because you have this darkness within you. She wouldn't want you. She would reject you, because that's how he feels about himself. But at that point, when Leia's actually gone, she can't go back because she's literally gone. So that causes this yearning, but it can't possibly be fulfilled. So where does it go from there, essentially? What's left? And then you have healing the mother-daughter split. And talking about this happening in a very compressed way, I'd argue that happens when Rey heals Kylo Ren. essentially, because Leia was intervening as a way to try and reach her son, as a way to try and save her son. And Rey, in that moment, she's acting to save Kylo Ren, and she's doing it through of her own volition. She's not like under mind control by Leia or anything, but she's like inspired by Leia's action, inspired by that intervention from Leia. And so in doing that, she's healing the split that was in existence between Leia and her own son. And because we've had all this mirroring between Kylo and Rey, in the sense that they're two halves of the same person, it's almost like healing something within herself when she heals him.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a really pivotal moment in that way. And then healing the wounded masculine. Obviously, there's a very literal healing the wounded masculine when she heals Kylo Ren. But I think mythologically, when that's happening is when she's confronting Palpatine on Exegol. Because you
she offers to save him.
Yeah, because like obviously Palpatine, he's like, yes, yes, I will be evil. You know, being wonderful Ian McDermott. But yeah, like I think what he really wants is for her to give in to all her darkness, all this darkness that's been tormenting her the whole movie, and, you know, embrace it so then he can possess her, basically. But Rey refuses to do that. And she, like, insists, you know, no, I won't hate you. You know, I refuse to hate you. And she takes this, like, really strong, adamant stance. And to me, that's Rey healing that, like, wounded masculine part of herself and reconciling with her own darkness. Because that feeling that had been troubling her the whole time, in that moment, she's, like, resolved within herself and she's found that peace. So that conflict is gone at that point. And then beyond duality, it's a little bit premature, so it's not quite exactly the end of the movie. But I'd argue that's essentially the union with Kylo Ren. And I know we have the kiss up there because, yeah, why not? Why not? But I think where you really get that most powerfully embodied is when there's that first Force connection between Rey and Kylo Ren on Exegol, where they trade the saber, essentially. And there's no words spoken. You just see the close-ups of their faces and you just recognize implicitly that there's this really profound connection between them. And they don't need words because they just understand each other without any recourse to language, essentially. And that's the ultimate integration of these masculine and feminine aspects that both characters have. It's Ben Solo, like, healing his own, like, self, you know, and finding that balance, and also Rey finding the same balance in herself. Yes, that's a lot. Do I have another slide right now? Thank God I can rest. So essentially what we did earlier is, you know, we touched upon briefly how each of the original trilogy and prequel films, there's a hero's journey going on in each of those individual films, but then there's a wider journey spanning the whole trilogy when you look at all three films as a whole. So we're going to just... we're just going to reassign ourselves back our chosen films and talk through the stages again and consider how they map differently now.
We had talked about before how the first part of the journey very much maps the hero's journey. It's very traditional, and TFA does map the most to what we conceptualize as the hero's journey. She leaves home, she goes on her road of trials, but of course she's identifying as a more masculine person within this movie, and gathers allies, BB-8, Finn, Han, Chewie. They face dragons and ogres on the road of trials, the ogre being Kylo Ren, maybe a predator as well. And then she experiences the boon of success by actually using the Force and getting the saber away from Kylo Ren and defeating him. This is entirely illusionary, though.
Yes. So that leads us into TLJ, where we have spiritual rigidity and death. Rey's trying to achieve all these goals that are dependent on external masculine sources. She's rejected by Luke. She's rejecting her femininity. She's failing her mission. She's lost. She's confused. She temporarily succeeds in getting Luke to train her, but he rejects her again because of her raw power. Initiation and descent to the goddess. Her entire sense of identity is destroyed. And her experience in the Mirror Cave, which basically acts as an ego death and also a rebirth that forces her to let go of her past and start choosing her future on her own terms. Yearning to reconnect with the feminine, she starts to step into her feminine power, acting out of compassion for herself and for Kylo, taking control of her future instead of waiting for men to tell her what to do, and being reborn as this kind of new symbolic mother of the new resistance at the end of TLJ, when she frees them from the cave.
Lovely. Oh, crap. Spoiler. You didn't see that. You didn't see anything. So Tross, in this like overarching trilogy mapping, healing the mother-daughter split. That's essentially what I was talking about before, about Rey having this new nurturing relationship with Leia now and having that mother figure that she previously lacked. So that's like the beginning of the journey towards like her healing, her ultimate healing, essentially, because she is having that relationship now that she never had before. Then I'd say healing the wounded masculine in the wider context Rey wrestling with that inner darkness and processing it over the course of the movie. And then integrating masculine and feminine is basically the same. It's about Rey and Ben Solo embracing that connection between them and finding like just this perfect equilibrium, essentially balancing light and dark, masculine and feminine. And essentially that union, when they come together at the end of Tross, that's Rey accepting the darkness within her own nature, and as well as like realizing finally that the light she's always seen in Ben Solo is indeed there, and that he's proving it through his actions at that point, essentially. And yeah, I think essentially the key point with that bond between them is that by becoming reconciled to each other at the end of that movie, they also become reconciled to themselves. So it's about healing those like wounded parts of themselves through their connection with each other. Okay, so now it's not a spoiler. So yeah, at the beginning we asked a question essentially about what are the sequels adding, you know, like what questions do they answer? And essentially I'd say it all comes back to compassion, really, because like with the rise of Skywalker and how that brought back Palpatine, what that did is it established Palpatine as the constant evil across all Star Wars movies, essentially. So he's the Phantom Menace in Episode 1, and then he's the big bad in Episode 9, as sort of like this spectral
Snoke as well.
From beyond the grave.
Yeah,
so he's back. And obviously an obsession of Palpatine's, like an obsession of many Sith, is like life beyond death, essentially. Like, how do you conquer death? And that's what he promises to Anakin in the prequels, because Anakin is terrified of losing the people he loves, and so he's very easily seduced by the idea that he could save Padme from death, essentially. And that's what Palpatine sucks him in with, this promise. But it's like a poison chalice, because in the end, that's actually what kills Padme, you know, by going down that path and listening to Palpatine. And then obviously you get to see like compassion enacted in the original trilogy, because Luke has compassion towards his father, and that's, you know, how Vader is redeemed through his son's compassion. But I think what you don't get with the original trilogy is you don't get any exploration of that masculine-feminine dynamic, because it's very much familial bonds in the original trilogy. Mm-hmm. And what was at stake in the prequels and also in the sequels is this masculine-feminine dynamic and that tension between the two. So then when you get to the sequels, it's almost a bit like a reverse Anakin and Padme situation, because in the prequels, you start off with Anakin adoring Padme as this innocent little boy, and he just loves her wholeheartedly, and it's very pure kind of love. But then by the time you get to Revenge of the Sith, it's a very twisted, possessive love that's like dangerous and destructive. And then in The Force Awakens, you obviously start off like the whole Hades and Persephone thing when he like kidnaps her, you know. And
it's like very Predator.
Yeah, like a Predator. It's not good vibes at that point, you know. There's a lot of work to do in that relationship, suffice to say. And that's what you get in The Last Jedi. You get this complication of that dynamic, and you find that they become like more equal over the course of that film. And you understand them more, like not in terms of like a power differential, but more like on the same level, essentially, at that point. And you see how great they can be when they work together, you know, with that whole throne room fight. That's part of what makes it so spectacular, because you buy into the bond between those characters in that movie, and you really want them to join forces, you really want them to work together. And then when you get to The Rise of Skywalker, obviously there's a lot of pain and trauma and angst in the dynamic at that point because of the betrayal in The Last Jedi. But ultimately, that's all worked through. And, you know, I think when she stabs him, essentially, it's just this, like, overwhelming, like, flood of, like, realizations and emotions. And it's this recognition that he's not been a good person up till that point, to put it very politely. He has lots of issues to work through. But equally, she realizes how deeply she cares for him and how she just can't hide that anymore, you know, and she has to confess it. Like, that's been part of her shame and her trauma, the fact she hasn't been able to be open about the fact she has feelings for him. So when in The Rise of Skywalker she says, "I did want to take your hand, Ben's hand," that's her finally being open for the first time. And yeah, then obviously it goes through to Exegol and he does come back and he does prove that her faith was justified. And then, you know, they obviously have that like reunion against Palpatine, then Ben's tossed aside, and then like Rey dies, and like all sorts of things happen in this movie. But yeah, ultimately when he crawls out of that pit and Rey is dead and he's holding her in his arms, you know, you see his face, it's a wonderful performance, the devastation is real, it's incredibly compelling. And I think what you see there when he heals her, that's essentially them claiming the power that Palpatine wanted but was never able to get, because it was a power that didn't actually belong to the dark side, it belonged to something purer that was like on the light side and just waiting to be discovered there. And it's only at the very end, by acknowledging the connection between the two of them and acknowledging the strength of feeling, that they're finally able to like have that ultimate union, you know, where they're literally trading life force, because Rey gave him some of her life force to bring him back after she stabbed him. And then Ben gives Rey all of his life force to bring her back after she dies. And it's done wholeheartedly without any expectation of anything in return. So it's the opposite of the Anakin and Padme dynamic in Revenge of the Sith, because that's all about possession and what Anakin wants from Padme rather than what he can give to Padme. So I'd say that that's essentially what the sequels are bringing to Star Wars, like as a whole, really. I think that's what they add to the mythology, and I think that's why they have a valuable place in Star Wars, really.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
rapidly running out of time.
Yeah.
George, this is all what it's about. It's all about compassion, and it's what brings us past duality. So,
I think that's it.
Yeah, I mean, you kind of covered everything I was going to talk about already.
I'm so sorry.
Okay. George Lucas is a massive sap after my own heart, and is very much just like, love is the message. Love is the most powerful force in the universe, and obviously compassion is a really powerful facet of love, and we see that ideology throughout all of the films. Yeah, I think should we move on to Rey?
Yeah, I think this deserves a clap.
This is a little spanner in the works. We were like, we gotta add a slide.
We have a minute and a half
to talk about.
Exactly. This is a special surprise, people. Obviously we have 2 minutes just about. So yeah, should we do quick thoughts from each of us? So Laurie, you go.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just hoping that they're bringing Rey back for reasons that are integral and specific to her character and allows for a full, cathartic, healing journey for her, which I personally feel like she didn't fully get in the sequel trilogy. I don't want them to be just bringing her back because they need a Jedi master and she's the only one. I'm like, what is it about Rey that you want to bring her back for? And then, like, all that we kind of know is that it's going to be her rebuilding this new Jedi Order. And so, like, my big questions are like, okay, so what does that mean? Because, like, I have a lot of issues with the Jedi Order. And I just really want them to be, like, really brave with what that looks like. And
yeah,
interrogating the failings of the Jedi, tearing it down, starting it again, being informed by Rey's personal experiences. And I think my main issue with the Jedi is this whole attachment equals bad thing, which arguably causes the entire tragedy of the Skywalker saga, because Anakin never knows how to express his emotions.
They should have burnt the books.
Yeah.
They should have burnt the Jedi texts.
Actually burnt them.
So yeah, I just, you know, whenever you forbid something or don't talk about something, you inevitably force it into the shadows and closer to darkness, which is obviously what happens with Anakin and his love for Padme. It becomes toxic because he's force tied it. So I really want them to kind of, I really hope they explore that kind of thing and interrogating that.
Yep, you got 10 seconds.
Okay. It's entirely possible if they want to bring Ben back, it would be a lost husband journey. That's from a folklore and from a fairy tale mythic perspective, Psyche and Cupid is already deep, all the way through the sequel trilogy, and easy to do if they want to make it happen.
Yeah. I just want catharsis.
Yeah. Yeah. Done. Catharsis. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, so as you can hear in that recording, my answer when asked what I need from a continuation of Ray's story is catharsis. That answer does kind of speak for itself, but just to expand slightly, if you were paying close attention to what I was saying about The Rise of Skywalker, yeah, you'll have noticed that I don't really go into the movie after Exegol, and obviously there's more things that happen, you know, Rey reunites with her friends on the Resistance base, and crucially, she goes back to Tatooine, buries the Skywalker sabers, and proclaims herself Rey Skywalker at the very end of the movie. And I don't talk about those things in the panel because I find them very hard to parse in mythological terms, in terms of what they mean. I guess on a very basic level, it's essentially that final stage of the hero's journey, right? Where you go back to where you started from, but you have like a new like level of knowledge and a new level of insight that you're taking back with you to the place where you started. But that is obviously different from what's going on with the heroine's journey, which I feel that each of the sequel trilogy films aligns with more closely as a rule. And I feel like even that sense of learning lessons and going back with like new wisdom and new insights to where you started from, I feel like that's kind of undermined by Rey calling herself a Skywalker, because that represents a kind of denial. It's not her accepting herself, it's her denying herself in a way. And yeah, I just feel like the Rey we see at the end of The Rise of Skywalker is a Rey who hasn't processed what she's been through. It's a Rey who's very traumatized, who's, yeah, just coping however she can. That's how I have to rationalize it, essentially. I know there's meta, real-world reasons why they made certain decisions about how to end the movie. But in terms of a storytelling interpretation, the only way I can make sense of that is as like a trauma response, in the sense that that's how she's choosing to cope in that moment after having gone through so much and, yeah, just suffering so terribly. You know, that's the only way I can make sense of it. So I think in terms of seeing Rey 15 years later, what I would really want to see is her essentially facing up to the fact that you can't just retreat back to the nostalgia and the safety that's represented by the Skywalker name. That there has to be a breakaway from that at some point, because obviously it was self-evident that Luke Skywalker made many mistakes with his own Jedi Order, for example, and he was the first person to tell Rey about that, and he was very troubled and open and explicit about how he'd failed essentially as a teacher. So I think the last thing I want to see in this new film is Rey just continuing that sort of like blind hero worship. I need to see like a more critical view of the way that Luke did things, and also just more generally the way that the Jedi did things overall as an order, you know, certain practices that I find impossible to reconcile with their heroic condition, like the whole taking babies from their families thing. I find that very difficult to accept. And I feel like Rey would also find that very difficult to accept. So essentially, I think there's lots of really, really cool storytelling possibilities in terms of Rey coming back 15 years later as a Jedi Master. But I also think there's going to be a fine balancing act between making like a populist popcorn flick, you know, that all the crowds will love, with great action scenes and great action adventure, and also still trying to tell a character story for her that makes sense. And it's important to say that there's rumours that Rey won't actually be the main character in this movie, that she'll be a supporting character. And I'm not necessarily opposed to that, because I'm of the view that supporting characters can still very much have their own journeys. And I think there's lots of cool, interesting stuff you can do with Rey as a supporting figure to new leads, and their stories could intersect in all sorts of interesting ways. So yeah, I'm very, very excited by the promise of a Rey movie, and I think there's many, many places they could go, but I think ultimately the thing I most want to see for Rey is a sense of catharsis and a sense of her truly wrestling with and ultimately making peace with her past, rather than just denying what's happened to her, essentially, and trying to return to past glories and find comfort in them, because I don't find that a very satisfying conclusion to her story on a personal level. So yeah, I'm sure I'll talk a lot more about this when I podcast with Kirsty about all the news, but I just wanted to add that on as an addendum to my one-word answer in the panel. So yeah, thank you so much for listening, everyone, and be excited because Rey's back. Yay! Goodbye. Okay,